Accession number 30059, Reel 7.
And it was generally smooth, and I would say so, but Terrell was the only one that...
His was mostly stupidity,
I think. I know what it was. He wrote a book. My aeronautical library is still back in Arkansas, still. And I have a copy of his book. And I've never in my life read so many misstatements of fact. So many self-serving statements. It's what I would expect of him anyway. But we didn't care who got the credit. It wasn't a question of that at all. But he made so many misstatements of fact. He gave no credit to my outfit. I wanted the outfit to get some credit. I didn't care if it was personal credit or anything, because although I had done, along with Al Key, had done all the test flying. And landing a B-17, one thing that I can remember, after we had flown the Disney bomb on B-17 for, well, I don't know how many times, on the range that the British had for calibrating bomb sites and bomb drops and the ballistics of bombs and all that sort of thing. I said one night, I wonder how that airplane would fly if one of those things hung up 2,000 pounds out here, 2,000 pounds out there. How the airplane would fly if both of them hung up, or more particularly if only one of them hung up. We never land an airplane with one on the outside. So I said, I think we'll have to find out what happened. So the next day, I made a wooded couple on. And, took the warhead off. I found out they put the wrong bombs on. And the bombs that I finally landed with had the warhead on. And when I landed, I can remember the armor running up to me and saying, "Oh my God, I'm glad you're back safely, Colonel." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Those bombs have got the warhead still on there." Anyway, the airplane landed on it with the bombs on it. It was necessary because the release mechanisms sometimes at high altitudes, through the cold and the grease and everything on it, they just wouldn't release.
Did you land it with both of them on?
Both are.
You didn't try it with one?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did? And it worked good.
I recovered from that.
I did
recover. And another one, a slow recovery, but yes, I did the next day with one on.
And hung up in the sense that they were both still in parallel.
Well, they were
not they had not been partially released.
No, the way that thing was hung on there, if they had ever gotten hung up and swung on there, it would blow the airplane up. Because when the release was tripped, it activated the fusing in the bomb. And it would have been a pretty messy situation.
Did it activate the rocket simultaneously?
No, the rocket was activated barometrically. The bombs were dropped from 20,900. The exact altitude is because they had to be 19,250 feet. Now that was indicated, and they had correction tables, so 20,000 feet was the critical altitude they should be released. And when they got to terminal velocity, beyond which they would never go without some help, which is, you know, is a major function of the weight and everything. When they got to terminal velocity, which was about 15,000 feet, 14,000, 15,000 feet, the rocket motor cut in barometrically. And it was a great sight. You see these things just going down like that, and all of a sudden you see a little puff of smoke, and then you lose sight of them. It goes so fast.
Yes.
And there was some picture to it.
What type of fuel did they use?
They had a they had two different kinds of fuses.
Fuel. Rocket fuel.
Solid fuel. Another project that I forgot to mention, and this is kind of jumping back in here, was the development of the Droop Snoop, which was a very significant contribution to the war effort. It was my idea, and it was Don Ostrander who I got assigned to my outfit, who was an ordnance expert. And I developed the thing with the help of Langford Lodge, again, up in North Ireland. And we, as you know what the Droop Snoop is, we flew the first, Don and I flew the first operational missions in the Droop Snoop too. And there was another thing that, a little bit late for the war, had it been done a little bit earlier, would have made a big difference, because as you know from what you may have read about the Droop Snoop, the P-38s carried two 2,000-pound bombs outboard. And the groups, they were formed fairly close on the group. And when the group dropped its bombs, the P-38s had dropped it on. Later on, hi.
Hello! I've had some lunch.
I think it's a great idea.
No.
Doolittle called me one day and said that they're sending over a new radar altimeter, and I'm telling them to send down a B-26 from whatever group it was to you, and I want you to have that radar altimeter installed for me, and when we get it all installed and everything, I want you to fly with me and we'll check it out, because this was something new. And you know, radar altimeter is still right to the ground, just measured in feet instead of hundreds of feet. So we got it installed, and he was duly notified, and he notified me when he wanted me to stand by to fly, because the regulation said he had to have a co-pilot. But he said he wanted me to go along anyway to observe it. And he said, we're going up to I've forgotten the base, Poddington or one of the bomber bases anyway. He said, they've got personnel problems up there. And he said, I think it's all on account of what I think is probably a weakness of a group commander, or maybe the deputy commander of the group. He said, I don't just put it, there are problems if there are too many losses and so forth and so on. So he said, we'll fly up there, and if we have a chance to, it was a miserable day, my God, it was terrible. It kind of made, I really liked to fly the way he liked to fly. And he said, this is an ideal day. We've got this radar altimeter. We can fly right on the treetops, which we did. And he said, but the only when you get up there, I want you to prepare to stay for 4 or 5 days. Fly a mission or two with them if you want to. And sit around and visit them. See if you can get a feel of what's... See how varied this job of mine was? Mm-hmm. They get a feel of what's going on up there, as well as the material and everything. Well, that trip up was something. I'll tell you, he got right down on the treetops, and that part of England was kind of hilly, and we were going like this all the time, and he was looking over at the radar altimeter all the time to see what it was saying. Instead of flying the airplane, I said, for Christ's sake, either let me tell you what the altimeter's saying, or you fly the goddamn airplane, or vice versa, but let's one of us fly the airplane. Well, we got there, finally, and I said to the group commander, pick somebody out of your pilot pool to fly back with him, because he has to have a co-pilot in the B-26 and it's required to anyway. And General Doolittle wants to go back about 1,400. So I said, have him report to told him with the airplane. I don't know how it's going to be right there. It was such a miserable day, and I wasn't a part of every part of this, but I put all the pieces together. This man who, this young officer, young second lieutenant, 2 days in the theater, had been given the job of flying back with Doolittle. And apparently, according to the weather officer, had come out, the minute he heard he was going to fly back with Doolittle, and he looked up at the weather, everything was grounded practically, he went right over to the weather office and began to ask questions about the weather. And then he came back a couple of times and finally, I walked into one end of the weather balloon because I was a little confused. It was getting, I thought, even a little bit worse, if anything. And as I came inside the door, I heard the weather officer say, "Lieutenant, you can't fly in this kind of weather." And this man said, this young lieutenant said, "Well, I'll tell you, sir," to this weather officer, "I'm scheduled to fly back with General Gula, and they tell me that son of a bitch will fly in any kind of weather." I looked at the other man of the weather officer here, Gula, was standing there and heard this whole thing. I thought, oh, sucker, beautiful. What's going to happen now? They went. About a week later, I saw General Gula when I came back to tell him what I thought about what was going on up at this base. I said, "Tell me now, unofficially, are you going to take any action?" I said, "I saw you standing over there." And he laughed and he said, "No, but if he'd said that old son of a bitch, I'd had him court-martialed." typical of Gula. Great sense of humor. Well, we were talking about what the Droop Snoop, weren't we?
Yes, we were talking about Droop Snoop.
Well, we got it made, and Ostrander, who was the ordnance officer assigned to 8th Fighter Command, first place, we had a hard time getting approval for this thing. In fact, we didn't ever get approval for it. We didn't get approval for a lot of things we did, and that was one of our secrets. We got them done without asking for approval. We seldom asked for approval when we knew we would get turned down. In fact, we never preferred to start somebody putting obstacles in our way. So in this particular case, I went to Lockheed up in Northern Ireland, up at wherever they were, and told them what I wanted to do. And they said, "Oh, Lord, you never know, well, we can't do it." And I said, "Well, come on, now you got a chance to prove how versatile this airplane is, and you're not too busy up here now anyway, and sit around getting fat on this ham and eggs and everything that you've got, but we're eating beans and beans on toast and Brussels sprouts. Now, help me out." Well, I knew them all pretty well. They finally agreed how they would. So Ward Beema, who was the next under Hall Hibbert, the director of engineering at Lockheed, who was in the UK then assigned to my outfit, said, "I'll help you. I'll be the go-between, and I'll take some of the responsibility for this, and you won't have to worry about it." That's how we got it done. I thought, well, gee, you're going to take an airplane out of commission and everything. I better tell General Hunter just about the time he's getting relieved to what I want to do, and unofficially, and see if he minds. So much that nobody's going to get hung. I don't want to get really shafted. I told General Hunter what I wanted to do, and he said, "Well, as far as I'm concerned, off the record, take your airplane if you want to, and let them do anything they want to it. But don't let me know about it, because you're going to have full responsibility for it." Anyway, we got it done with the help of people at the Langford Lodge. And in the meantime, I had gotten Don Ostrander, who was the ordnance officer assigned to 8th Fighter Command, put on TV to my outfit, because Don and I had talked about this thing, and I had said to Don one night, I think this is, "What do you think about this idea?" And he said, "I think it's a great idea, and let's see if we can't work it out together." He said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll get myself assigned to a special school. They're running an advanced advanced bombardier training over here. The English are running a school, and they're taking selected people in there, and I can get in because I'm an ordnance officer. I'm supposed to know all that's going on with the bombardiers, which is reasonable." So he got himself assigned. He said, "You get the airplane built, and I'll come back a full-fledged bombardier navigator, and between us we'll have this thing made, then we'll fly the first mission." This was all pie in the sky. Well, we got it made. Don came back from bombardier school. Well, we had a lot of things to do to it, too. The nose was so small, and they took all the guns out, that you had a little canopy that you, or a little plate that you took off of the nose on the port side, and you crawled in through. Then you had to lie down. There was no, well, you could sit up kind of like this if you wanted. You'd be much more comfortable just lying down. And the Nord, we put a plexiglass nose on it, as you know, and the Norden sight was right smack up in the plexiglass nose. And then there was oxygen and intercom controls over here, and you just barely get your parachute and dinghy. And we ran a half a dozen or more missions interior in the UK with it, and we never carried two 2,000-pound bombs on there before, which we did, and we tried all kinds of ballistics to see what, how good a bomb, how good a bomb sight base the P-38 was at high speed. That's what we wanted to. That was my idea, that the bombers were getting knocked down like flies almost at that particular point in time by flak and fighters, both. And they were ideal for these radar-controlled flak guns that the Germans had. It was duck soup, you know. They just tracked them right along like this and just put them burst right up where they were. And my idea was that the P-38 could be higher with these two 2,000-pound bombs, and faster by a good double. Because we could fly that airplane with those bombs on there at reasonably high altitude, around 25 to 30,000 feet, making good a good 375, 400 miles an hour, which was double the speed of the B-17s, double plus. And this would prevent, give their tracking, or their radar tracking, some problems. And also, my theory was that we only had to have one lead airplane with the group suit, and all the other P-38s would carry the two 2,000-pound bombs. And if we got jumped, they jettisoned the bombs and their fighters right away. They to protect the group suit, protect me, which I wanted, because you know it's kind of helpless sitting up there with a P-40 with a 45 caliber revolver, nothing else, no way to shoot it anyway if you wanted to. To shoot yourself. Well, anyway, we got the thing done. We ran these operational tests. We found it was an ideal platform. Yeah, we were putting those two 2,000-pound bombs in a pickle barrel, almost literally, from 30,000 feet. And I realized then all we had to do was keep a tight formation, and that there was enough of a lag in human lag that one. The bombs were released from the droop snoop. Everybody was watching it, and you could get a signal that you'd be ready, but they were watching, and the minute they see the bombs go away, they would trigger their bomb. But there was enough of a delay in lagging there, so that in effect they would all fall in the same area, and they did. So we ran our first seven or eight missions, Don and I did, leading the thing in the droop snoop. Our first one, I know, was run against Hoboken, which was a shipbuilding dry dock area and outside of, just outside of Antwerp. On the way back, one of our bombs hung up on the droop. We didn't know it, of course, until somebody called and said, you got one tip hanging down. That was the word I got. I said, oh, beautiful. I didn't like the idea, and I couldn't shake it off. I tried hard to shake it off, but on the way back, Oshander said, I want to have one more try at getting rid of that bomb. Do you mind? And I said, try all you want. The sooner you get rid of it, the better. And he said, there's a concentration of troops over there, tanks and a lot of other things. He said, let's make a little bomb run and I'll try to reuse it, not so I won't waste the bomb if I can get it away. So we made a regular, we picked an IP and made a regular bomb run, and the thing released and it fell right in the center of the thing, and it turned out to be a whole bunch of Dutch civilians. And before we even got our wheels on the ground, Queen Wilhelmina had General Doolittle on the telephone. what had happened. We tracked it all down to us. And I almost had court-martialed for it, even though it was a case of... but after all, we released him in an area that was completely in German hands, and German troops accepted it. And I found out later, at least according to the record, in the way that there were more Dutch civilians than there were German troops. It was this mishmash of people and tanks and everything else. That was one of the misfortunes of war.
It is war.
Yeah, after all, it is war.
Yeah.
And, but the group, I don't know how they didn't run too many missions because it was late in the war. And there were those that felt that the B-38 was needed worse as a fighter than it was as a fighter-bomber. And of course that was not a fighter-bomber in its real sense. A fighter-bomber in its real sense is one that releases bombs at low altitude and a dive type of bomb instead of a level from 30,000 feet. But it was ideal. We went over targets at 30,000 feet, 350 miles an hour, and beautiful bombing patterns. And I honestly believe that had there been sufficient material, that it would have been the ideal kind of operation for highly defended targets, small, like things like the Molly Dam some of the other things that were, they had nothing but anti-aircraft all over it, and a lot of fighter cover and everything else would have been ideal for that sort of
bridge type work, too. Mm-hmm. Bridges.
Ideal for the key bridges. Mm-hmm. Of course, the 8th and 9th Air Forces were doing a lot of, in that Operation Chattanooga, which was bridges and all moving targets and trucks and railroad trains and everything, they were getting the bridges, too. But this... I view it for highly defended targets. But the losses of any other type of bombardment would have been suicidal and unacceptable. And probably been impossible for them to destroy a target because they'd be on the ground before they ever got to the target. Highly defended targets like the Molly Dam. It's a typical thing. And we had laid out a whole bunch of targets. We ran some of them. And then Doolittle decided that we were doing too well, I think, really. And he said, you got other things to do. You're having too much fun. Go back and worry about what's happening to this rear turret on the B-17. Maybe. But the troop was a very successful. Came right out of the theater. No help from right field. And tin bending help from Lockheed, and some aeronautical engineering help in design of the plexiglass nose and that sort of thing.
Have to do a great deal of work to change the center of gravity, for instance.
Yes, taking the guns out of there. But of course, the bombardier navigator in the bomb site and all the other things you put up in the nose took up not only the space, but just about equalized the weight as well. Because we'd taken the 37-millimeter cannon out of the nose anyway, and we're using nothing but put in a 20-millimeter sometimes, on nothing but the 450 caliber machine guns. So it really wasn't a complicated operation. The shape of the nose and the location of some of the oxygen and that sort of thing. It's kind of bugs you. And if you turn that thing off, and that's another story, and kind of in connection with the groups, in a sense, I built the first piggyback P-38. Took the radio out and put a little bit of a seat back in there so that somebody could you know, lean forward. You had a hell of a crick in your neck by the time you got through, but that canopy, as you know, down like that, and you had to sit like that to get in, but at least you could ride in there. The only thing you shouldn't go very far in enemy territory, you stick all the armor plate off, too. While you had guns on there, it was going to be kind of tough on the to substitute a man for armor plate, and he'd get the short end of the stick. Will Rogers Jr. was sent out to the airport one day by somebody at APA headquarters, and he said, "I'd like to see that piggyback or that P-38 that you fixed up with two seats in it." I showed it to him. He said, "I'd like a ride in it." And I said, "Well, we don't can't carry anybody in these airplanes without an absolute authority from top headquarters." He said, "Well, you're a colonel." And I said, "True. But I'm not the boss by any manner of means. And you get a letter or a phone call, I get it from Doolittle or your chief of staff." And only those two people. And I left right in your seat, even see any of some of the secret stuff we were doing out here. It came through to take him for a short ride. Well, he was kind of a likable person. And he said, "Let's just go across the channel, just a little ways." And we did, and got some flak. We were fairly high altitude, but no fighters of any kind. And turned around and came back. And the next day, he had told the reporters in London about his trip into the combat zone riding on my shoulders. Well, the flak that I got, Doolittle, "What the hell are you doing in a combat?" I said, "I wasn't in a combat zone. Where were you?" And I said, "Well, just partway across the channel." He said, "You know, anywhere outside of England, it's in a combat zone." I said, "Yes, sir, I do." He said, "But I understand that from the story that you were well within the continent." And I said, "Well, we did touch on it here and there." He said, "Come on, how far in were you?" And I said, "More than 100 miles. I said, "You know, at that speed, General, it's just a matter of minutes." He said, "Yeah, I know the airplane. You don't have to give me lessons." And that, he said, "What's the truth of it?" I said, "Well, you know, the order came from your headquarters to give him a ride in the piggyback." And he said, "Yes, I know, but not outside of the UK or outside of the immediate area." And I said, "Well," he kind of talked me into it. "I'll admit, I'll take my medicine for it." But he said, "What's all this crap about his riding on your shoulders?" And I said, "Well, you know his button, General. You've seen the airplane. You know that he's pretty close. And I could hear him breathing hard half the time. But he wasn't riding on my shoulders. He was riding right back of me." Well, Doolittle got a reprimand from Arnold. First of all, it came Arnold to Spots, to Doolittle, to the Huff. I got a double reprimand. I came close to a court-martial. Doolittle said to me, "Well, I tell you what, I'll do. Jack Allard is the one that told you to take him." But I said, "Well, Jack," he said, "Jack and I'll testify at your court martial." I said, "That's a great help." "Have you testified at the court martial?" But the fact remains that I did do it. And he also, being testified at the court martial, he did testify at the court martial time, Doolittle did, in my defense. And if it hadn't been for that, I'd probably been shipped home. That was for on our own, setting certain operational limits on the Merlin engine, certain types of fuel that gave it better power and for combat use. And the word got back that it did ruin some engines, but haven't. That's the word. The engines have been hurt by something else, which you found out later. But the man from, I forgot which one of the wing commanders it was, that I'd be relieved of my job because I had given them such bum instructions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they had no recourse but to have a kind of a summary court and discuss the charges. That's what they said they were doing, actually. In fact, they were deciding whether it was going to go home or not. And when Doolittle heard about it, he came, walked right in the court martial and testified, and I, you know, he was an expert on fuels. You knew that.
No.
Doolittle's job before he went back in the Air Force in World War II, he was the head of the aviation department, Shell. And he had a doctorate degree from MIT, among other things, and his specialty, besides airplanes, was fuels for airplanes, high-powered engines and high-powered fuels. So when he spoke, it was with authority. And he just stood up in the court-martial and said what he did was absolutely right. There wasn't one single mistake. There was nothing wrong with the fuel, nothing wrong with the limits they set on those engines. Now forget this business. And that was the end of the court-martial. Or summary of the court, whatever they call it.
That's, I didn't know that about him. I didn't know that much about his background before the...
He's a highly qualified engineer in every respect, in every phase of engineering. He got his degree in aeronautical engineering at MIT, his master's degree in some specialized phase of engineering, of aeronautical engineering, and then he got his doctor's degree in aeronautical engineering. And he's a savvy guy. It was one reason he was a successful commander, because he knew his airplanes and he knew everything that was going on, and he got along with people well too. But you can see why, with that kind of a background, why this little outfit of mine was his baby.
Really. I understand that, man.
Oh, he just thought it was the greatest thing since sex that we had an outfit like that, and he followed our progress, or lack of it, probably as closely as he followed anything else. He was telling me that. He said, don't ever try to put anything over on me, because every day I know what you're doing out there. And he did. But he was delighted with some of the things that he would hand us. He handed us a project once, but about a month before D-Day, to figure out a way for the B-17s to carpet bomb the area directly ahead of the troops as they came ashore.